Welcome to Extroverted Developer, a podcast about technology and computer programming in New York City. Today we have a special guest, Jared Parsons from Microsoft. Hey, Jared.
Hey, guys. How's it going, Jared?
And there's Ben. Yay.
Going pretty good.
So, Jared, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I work at Microsoft. I've been here at Microsoft almost exactly 8 years now. Came here pretty much straight out of college and spent my entire time here working in some sort of dev tooling or another. I've worked on the VB language, worked on a lot of the Visual Studio tooling environment, and now I kind of work in a research project on dev tooling.
Does that have a code name yet that's public that you can talk about or no?
Has a code name.
But it's not public. Okay, yeah, no worries.
Nice.
You've done some pretty impressive public things, not just besides Microsoft and working on VB, but VSVim is probably my favorite plugin for Visual Studio.
Yes, I'm really glad people enjoy that.
You started this to learn F#, right?
Yep. Kind of towards the end of the Visual Studio 2010 release, that was a real fun release, but at times I felt like I lived in my office trying to really hammer it out and get it working. And I really just kind of – I needed a project towards the end to just kind of step back and say, okay, I need a break. I need to learn something new. I need to kind of get out of what I've been doing for a while. And at the time, there was no VI bindings available for 2010, and I kind of wanted them. And I at the same time, I was playing around with F#, and I'm like, this is a great idea. Let's just combine the two. And –
how did that work out? How did learning F# work?
It was really slow at first. I really had
that makes me no feel better.
Well, I had extremely limited experience. I had a lot of limited experience in functional programming up until that point. And so for a long time, I was really at first I started by trying to like overcompensate, and I was doing everything with lambdas. Everything was a continuation. And then I kind of reverted and I started doing kind of more imperative coding in F#. And I think it took about 2 or 3 months before I really kind of understood F#. And it's like kind of like once I realized, for instance, like what a discriminated union was and how incredibly powerful they were, it's like then the code started coming a lot faster.
So F# is your first functional language?
No, I did a little bit of Scheme in college, tutoring some people, getting them through their Scheme classes, but I had never actually done anything significant with a functional language before. I mean, you know, write a couple algorithms, a little bit of Haskell, but nothing really significant up until VSVim.
Nice. It must be nice to have somebody like Chris A. Smith to go ask questions about, the person who wrote programming F# for O'Reilly.
Yes, it was great to have because, you know, the F# team at the time was just down the hall from us. I actually went to school with Brian McNamara, who's kind of one of their lead developers. And so I spent a whole lot of time bugging them with F# questions. And a couple of blog posts I actually wrote on F#, Brian sent me some very nice private emails.
He's like, that's cute, but
I'm going to have to check out VSVim one of these days. It's been a long time since I've done any serious .NET coding, but I've just recently become a Vim fan. I came very, very late to the party. But
yeah, I started in Vim by watching Jared. Whenever I had a problem with the code that I was working on, I'd go over into his office. And not only is he using Vim key bindings in Visual Studio, but he's also writing code in Dvorak. Or he's using the Dvorak keyboard layout.
Yes, the ultimate geek keyboard.
Yeah, he's pretty hardcore.
That's awesome.
But that got me into Vim when I needed consistent editing experience across Mac OS, across Linux, and across Windows. And that's why I use the VSVim project. So thank you very much for writing it.
Thanks. Yeah, I would have loved that. I still it's so difficult to change between environments on a day-to-day basis. I hit Control S in Vim on a daily basis and usually have to Google how to get back out of it. By now it drops you into some sort of terminal mode. I forget what it is. Then you have to control Q or else it doesn't respond to anything.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's very
I still remember my first experiences with Vim. I actually started out as an Emacs guy a long
really?
Time ago. I had a professor in college who was obsessed with Emacs, and
I've never heard of somebody switching.
Well, what ended up happening was I was an Emacs guy up through my Java days. And then when I started taking a C course, we eventually had to do a Lex and a Yak project. And I spent about a week trying to get trying to install the Lex and Yak extensions for Emacs. And at the time, you couldn't find them. They didn't work. And if you saved an Emacs, it would go and indent your Lex file everywhere, which breaks it. and I was just tearing my hair out, and one of the other guys beside me was using Vim, and he was like, "Oh, look how awesome Vim is. It just works with Lex and Yak." And I'm like, "Show me how to use it." And so that's how I started in Vim. And after that, I've just kind of been a Vim guy.
That's awesome.
Yes, but I still remember the horror days of learning Unix. I'd accidentally type VI, it'd bring me into the shell, and I'm like, "What do I do? How do I get out of this?" If you were logged into like the console, it's like, "How do I kill this session?" I'd actually have to like log into another console to like find my first
find
console
proc and then kill it. Yeah. It's amazing where VS Vim or Vim bindings are like everywhere these days, right? JNK to navigate and Google Reader. Or every Linux tool, Unix tool like Less and things like that, they all use the Vim commandings. And so to me,
in Google Plus as well, you can jump through posts in Google Plus with JNK, and I believe there's key bindings for minimizing posts and Vim key bindings live on.
So I think Vim won between Emacs. I'm looking for the hate mail.
I mean, it definitely is ubiquitous. It really is amazing. It was really amazing. And sometimes I don't even realize, like, I just go, like, for Gmail, I just started using Vim Keep. It's like, oh, JK, you know, going back and forth. And later on, it's like, oh, they actually.
Yeah, that works.
Like, oh, that's why it worked. I just naturally do that with my fingers now and expect it to work kind of places.
Yeah, I think it's once you get into it and you stop using the mouse for navigation, then Vim is just a whole other animal. It's amazing what you can do with it.
And getting the hang of screen at the same time, because I'll jump between like, you know, multiple files. Yeah.
Now that I work a lot on Unix and not so much on Windows, but even in Windows at Microsoft, we're all sort of console jockeys. Like, nobody really uses the GUI for anything, even to build or stuff like that. We kind of turned Windows shell into the Unix shell to do all of our coding. And so being a command line person, Vim is awesome.
Doubly so for those who use Macs now. So
We're recording this podcast on a Mac because they've got really good audio support.
True.
Well, I mean, what's even like now when I go like to every program now after – you really get into Vim, I find whenever I go to any program, I'm always like, what are the key bindings? I don't want to touch the mouse. Like, how do I – like, I've gotten really good at navigating the Windows GUI by these archaic shortcuts, which are – it's funny to say archaic when I really like Vim, which has insanely archaic shortcuts. But
speaking of the key bindings, I mean, the key bindings are different for you because you're using Dvorak. Or are you still using Dvorak?
Yes, I still use Dvorak.
But that's got to be hard. Like, whenever you go to help somebody, nobody else is using Dvorak, right?
No. no one else is using it.
And so you need to know both. Has it?
Yes, it is really – like, I can still type 30 or 40 words a minute on QWERTY keyboards. But after I do it for, like, 10 minutes, I can get back into it.
Are
but,
J and K even next to each other on Dvorak? I don't know the layout. Yeah, I was like –
So do you remap Vim for the Dvorak keyboard so that it's
– No. I was learning – at the time I was learning the Dvorak keyboard, I just it's Control-Shift to switch between keyboards and Windows, and so I didn't want to constantly have to be Control-Shift and then open Vim and switch Vim back and forth. And so I just said, I'll just learn it this way. That may have not been the greatest idea in the world, but
– Interesting. Yeah, because those key bindings really are for the QWERTY keyboard.
They really are.
Interesting.
But really handy on I have Vim on my phone, which doesn't have, you know, doesn't have arrow keys, doesn't have, you know, a numpad or anything. So I've actually done
on an Android?
On an Android. I'll pull up the I forget the SSH client I use.
SSH.
For Android. pull up the keyboard, and I've actually done like little bits of coding, and Vim is great because, you know, I don't have any other way of, you know, getting around a screen. So.
Oh, I never thought about that. I wouldn't want to do that much coding on an iPad, but for quick little hacks.
Yeah, changes. You couldn't do it. Couldn't do it without Vim.
I can't even imagine having to do that. I mean, for me, VI is just – it's such muscle memory. It's just like if – sometimes I sit down and I'm like – someone's like, how did you do that? And I'm like, hold on a second. I have to type it out.
Type it out.
Attention. I have to pay attention to what I'm typing. I mean, you just asked me, are J and K next to each other? And I'm like, oh God, like where do my fingers go when I hit J and K? Like I cannot honestly remember. I think they actually might be C and D, but yeah. So I can't imagine like having to like pull my phone out and be like, okay, how do I
yeah, I was really proud of myself recently. I was on a train and had to like add an entry to a host file and then restart the server. And I was like, oh God, my phone. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
Cool. Oh, that's awesome.
So there's actually some news around VSVim. Originally, yeah. Microsoft had a policy that they can't accept external code changes, even for open source projects from non-Microsoft employees. But that's changed recently.
Yes, it's now VSVim is now fully and truly open. Anyone and everyone can contribute to it. I've actually had at least one non-Microsoftie contribute some code to it, so that was really exciting.
Yeah, but was he a former Microsoftie?
No, nothing to do with it. Wow. And he had never actually used F# before. And I had done the load ordering incorrectly for VimRC paths and he depended on it. And so he actually went through and fixed up the load ordering and sent me a patch for it. So that was really awesome.
That's fantastic. So if people want to get involved and help code VSVim, they just go clone your GitHub repository and then send you a pull request?
Absolutely.
It's like the rest of open source. It's fantastic.
No, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, GitHub has just been so awesome and revolutionary. And I know that Miguel de Icaza has been upset that Google Code Search kind of went dark a couple weeks ago. But I think that GitHub is going to pick this up again. I think that they're going to be the ones to really take it and run with it because it's so beneficial to their business model. And
yeah, and you can see you often see how popular a project's going to be by the number of people who are commenting on it. It's just like a huge forum that you can also add code to. I don't know. It's incredible.
Yeah, they made the open source much more approachable. Before I was send me a patch and get it approved on this mailing list and do.
And much more social in its own way. Yeah,
much more social. Fantastic.
It really, I'm amazed at how social it is and how easy it is to talk about issues when you're doing a code review, like if you're doing a comment on the code and to be able to like pound in the issues or pound in the shud that's causing the problem. Like it just makes it, it's just all right there. Like,
yeah, you can reference a request or reference a,
right.
Yeah.
It's just awesome.
So speaking of social coding, there's, I think social coding sort of started with Stack Overflow, right? That's the first
time.
Yeah,
I think that's where.
Like
it's been
people
most
would
successful.
Put out problems and really be able to get answers to solutions. And Jared, I know you're a huge fan of Stack Overflow.
Fan, addict.
Addict might be appropriate.
Might be.
What are you up to? 180K?
Yeah, I think about 183.5 right now.
83.5. So, yeah, round it.
183, something right around there.
I'm at 586.
Nice. I don't even want to talk about my.
What I hate about Stack Overflow is that all of my reputation comes from this one question, which is, it's like, how do you code Android apps for IntelliJ? And my answer is just, here is the link to IntelliJ. Go download it. It's native. It's built in. And that is by far the thing I've gotten the most reputation on, is people not Googling or reading.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think my most upvoted question was also just a link to like a jQuery library.
Right? It's
yeah.
Like, oh.
It's like I'm a little ashamed of that one. I mean, like, I Googled it. He didn't.
Do you have a favorite answer that you've given, Jared?
Maybe not favorite. My most popular. When we talk about the simplest answers get the most votes. Like, my most popular answer of all time is someone asked, how can you do a – basically, how can you see if a string in C#, how does a string start with another string and ignore case? And I was like, oh, here's the two-line extension method.
Yeah.
I think 10 votes a week on that still. Like, I get 5 to 10 votes a week on that, and they'll come in waves sometimes. Like, I won't get a vote for a few days, and then I'll get, like, 8 votes in one day. And it's like, I really wish I could figure out how people are getting that question. It's by far my most popular, and I don't. It's one of the simplest answers I've ever given. But
so Jim said you were number 3 on Stack Overflow for a while.
Oh, now you sent a correction. He's number 4.
You're number 4. Okay.
My bad.
Is there like high competition among the top 10? Do you know each other's names and
Do you have a support group?
We do. At one point, I've been number four twice. I think I'm number 10 right now. But, I mean, there's definitely a lot of competition. I mean, it's just friendly. Like, we're all just trying to answer questions. And it's gamification of helping people. And so it's both just fun and rewarding. But there is the gaming aspect to it. But it can be, you know, pretty competitive. I mean, you look at John Skeet, who right now is actually – John Skeet, I think he's going to get 400K in probably the next week or so. But he, if you look on like kind of he's the number one, you know, all-time user in Stack Overflow. But if you look on kind of like the weekly, like who's winning the weekly rep battles, I think he averages two – like not even – he's not always number one on the weekly battles now. With the guy who is number three on Stack Overflow is actually usually the highest week-to-week user now. But even if he keeps this up, it would take, I don't know, like 10 years to catch John.
It just seems so ridiculous. Like John Skeet. But his most popular thing on Meta is, how does John Skeet get so much rep on Stack Overflow? And he laid out a very detailed, like, from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m., I'm at home making breakfast, and I'm on Stack Overflow doing this, and then I'm on the phone, on the train.
Who is John Skeet? This is the first time I've heard of him.
Jared probably knows him better than I do. Well, I don't know him. I just know of him.
Well, John Skeet, he works at Google right now, but I think he's kind of most originally known for, he has a really great blog, does a lot of blogging on C#, the language, and he's written a lot of really great books on C#. So John Skeet writes C# in depth, and so it's gone through various revisions, and it's a great book. And he's just amazing at Stack Overflow. Like, there's just no other way to describe it. He writes books on C#. And he works in Java, I believe, since he works at Google. And so C# and Java are the number one and two tags on Stack Overflow, and he's just amazing at them.
Yeah, and he loves things about like virtual machines and understanding the hardware and the garbage collector and all that. Very low level and static. He really loves questions about static initialization. That's like his bread and butter. If he listens to this, he's going to yell at me.
Yeah, well, what's really fun is a lot of times he challenges like the conceptions of C#. Like, I think in C# 3 or 4, they changed static initialization a bit, and he actually just on his blog enumerated all the different ways static initialization could occur, then did it in C#, the various versions of C#, and then brought out the IL. And other ones he challenges, like structs and C#s, can't have constructors. Mm-hmm. And if you actually look at that, that's not a CLI restriction. That's a C# restriction. Right. And so he went through and hand-coded a bunch of structs in IL, compiled them to a library, and then basically started calling them from C# and initializing them and it's parameterless constructor, sorry, and seeing like when would the constructor be called, when would it not be called, and just really great post about like kind of, you know, picking up the open up the hood and let's see what's going on underneath.
That was one of the things that was always very interesting to me working at Microsoft. While you have the people who wrote the language there, sometimes the best information was not at Microsoft, right?
Yes.
People like John Skeet are just crazy.
Yes. Well, now Eric Lippert's giving him a run for the money on Stack Overflow.
I do see that.
Well, when you've written a language, I assume you get so close to it that maybe you don't always understand necessarily the use cases of
Lucian's
the people actually
Stack
writing
Overflow?
Anything in it.
I think Lucian's done a few posts on Stack Overflow, but he doesn't spend a lot of time there.
Yeah, probably not as many VB questions as there are C# questions. So, all right.
Not as many. There definitely. I think C# is the number one tag, and I think VB is not in the top 20 anymore. It used to be for a while, but it's kind of fallen behind with JavaScript and PHP getting a little more popular. But
so you're definitely a hardcore language guy. Have you ever wanted to build your own language?
Who hasn't?
What? This is something I do not want to do.
Not even a little bit.
To be honest, when I was put on the VB team, I knew that this was a dream job for some other programmer. And that they would all hate and be jealous of me.
I actually, when I was in college, I was a teaching assistant in a compilers class for a long time.
Okay.
And one of my professors used to always say, he was like, the only two interesting things in computer science are operating systems and programming languages. And I was like, well, I guess I'm going to operating systems then, because programming languages are boring. I absolutely hated programming languages in college. I just TA'd it because I really liked working with C and telling people how the programming languages – intro to programming languages class was also our intro to C class. And I thought that was kind of a nice – it's always one of my favorite teaching languages because it's very mean to you.
Yeah, but, you have to really understand how computers work when you're dealing with low-level C.
Yeah, not C++, and the order – yeah, no, we just, it was low level, bare bones C, ANSI, pedantic wall. And it was the way our college kind of taught was you got Java. So it's this nice Java GUI introduction. It's like, and here's C. This is how it all works.
And here's the cliff. Good luck.
And then I got to Microsoft and I started working in dev tools for a while, but I wasn't actually working on languages. And I saw the position open up for a compiler and I was like, well, at least I kind of know how it works. And then I joined the team and I learned two things. One, I didn't know how real world compilers work. And two, languages are awesome.
So I love that languages are awesome. But I think about English, like the English language, and I'm never like, you know what would make English so much better is if we brought back thou, if we had you singular instead of you plural. These are thoughts that I just never enter my head. And yet computer programmers are like, man, Python would be so much better if – I can't even think of some.
What if there were modes
things?
In English, you know?
I just never think about that. I just try to learn English as best as I can and express the ideas as well as I can in that language. I don't go, man, I could really express ideas better if the language were different. But you compiler people, you definitely are like, oh, no, we can have a much richer expression of ideas in these languages.
Yeah. I think a lot of it just comes from I just end up playing with a ton of languages. So I always have kind of like every other year, I always try to go out and learn a new programming language and not even necessarily like one to kind of keep myself fresh and to not get stuck in a rut. And two, because the popular programming language that they always have something that makes it productive versus something else. And a lot of times I learn another language and can take those concepts and apply them back to the things I'm working on. One of the big ones is like working in F# and correct by construction, or working in C++ and having non-null types, or in F# just obsession with type inference and just making – it really kind of taught me. It's like, oh, this is how I can kind of construct my code so that it's going to be more type inference friendly in C#. And how can I make Lambda – like F# also really emphasizes Lambdas and functional programming, and it's kind of changed the way I think about problems even though I'm in C#. It's like that would be a great pace to throw Lambda at or things of that nature. But it eventually leads to you saying, God, I wish Lambdas were done better in C#, or I wish I could have JavaScript's dynamic property access over here, and which naturally leads you to say, I want this language to be better.
Is that why you want to create your own language? Do you think you would add lambdas to C++ and create Jared++?
Well, C++ 11 actually has lambdas now.
0x had lambdas, yes, as well.
Yeah, 0x. I've actually checked a few into our code base, much to the surprise. Yes, I love them. They're actually really C++ lambdas are really nice in a lot of different ways. See, this is where it comes back to where I learned like, you know, my first real introduction to lambdas was C#, and C# lambdas are nice, but they're fairly limited in that they're always heap-based, so they're always going to be an allocation, which is a cost. They always capture by reference, which causes people nightmares and for loops and such.
It is nice then you go 0x that you can choose whether you want it to be copy or reference.
Right. I mean, it's the classic C++ feature where you can do it any way you want to do it and get pay as much as you want or as little as you want for a lambda. And so it's really nice to basically have that control. And then you go back to C# and you're like, wow, it's like that C++ lambda literally cost me nothing on the heap. I can do everything on the stack. It's just a stack type. I can do an iteration without an I can do kind of like a summing operation without an allocation. And everything is happy. But with C#, it's like I have to do the trade-off of that's a heap allocation. If I'm calling that a whole bunch in a loop, am I polluting the garbage? Am I polluting the heap a little bit too much here? Or things of that nature.
Especially when you start dealing with large objects that get allocated inside.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
On that subject, how deep do you think that computer programmers need to go in order to be good at their jobs? It seems like you probably don't need to understand every single thing about hardware. Like, you don't need to know that if you push D flip-flops too hard, that sometimes they won't latch. Right? Like that.
Right. I don't even know what that means.
So D flip-flops are like memory in a computer, and that's how they set bits, like way down in the.
I guess it depends on your job, right? It depends on whether it's your job to need to know that, or whether you need to know how event bubbling works in the DOM.
I think most programmers don't even need to know about, like, we just talked about the lambdas thing, right? About heap allocations versus stack allocations. Most web developers, they're just like, oh, you can click and buy the widget that we're selling, and that's all that really matters. Would Facebook be a better website if they could write everything in C++ and decide whether or not it was by reference or by value passed to the constructor?
Well, I think at this point, Facebook has
probably
enough hardcore developers that they actually are going into – they're going in and rewriting PHP and then, you know, sending those upgrades back into the community.
What do you think, Jared? I mean, you have to know pretty low level working at Microsoft when you're developing the languages, right? You need to go all the way down to assembly.
Yeah, sometimes. But I mean, the way when I look at programming today and my job and everyone I talk to, I don't see how it's possible to be someone who just knows one programming language anymore.
Okay.
Like, it's just what I really try to encourage, I see some people who are like spend a whole lot of time and they can tell you a little bit about JavaScript, a little bit about PHP, a little bit about how like cascading style sheets interact in funny ways. But what I really think kind of makes sense in today and what I tell people who are going into computer science is learn one language really, really, really well. Like, become as much of an expert as possible in one language. Try to understand the full breadth of that language and then become competent in two or three other languages. Just spend some time, write some programs every 6 months or so. Just go out, learn a new language. In terms of like how deep do you have to go, how high do you have to go, it's really job specific. Like, I've actually mostly avoided – I never have really learned assembly language, and I work on a compiler. I mean, I mostly work on managed languages, so I spend a lot of time – I know all kinds of crazy things about IL that no one – in their right mind really wants to know.
I'm surprised to hear you say that you don't really know assembly.
No, and actually a coworker we both worked with, Jason Malowinski, for a long time, whenever I have to do assembly debugging, I used to call him into my office and get him to explain the semantics. It's like, okay, what does that do? That instruction is causing the problem. Explain that to me. I mean, I can read some assembly,
but
I cannot
out
and write an assembly program for you.
Yeah, the EAX, like, enhanced instruction set, I mean, there's a little bit too much there to learn. Because Intel is constantly trying to make their processor relevant, and so they keep adding all these special features that, I mean, it's its own expertise. You need to understand all of the different registers they give you access to, as well as all the instructions, like the SSE and the MMX I mean, MMX is from the 90s, but yeah, enhanced instruction sets.
Yeah, and it's pretty crazy. I mean, even Googling the low-level instructions sometimes don't produce great results. Like, I remember one time I was looking up one, and I was going through, like, kind of an assembly manual trying to understand what it was, and Jason walked in my office. I'm like, what is that? And he's like, oh, that's just a cute way of multiplying by two.
Yeah. You were shit.
And he just looks at it, and he knows. And I spent an hour, like, trying to, like, what does this do? No, it wasn't even a shift instruction. It was, like, using – I can't even remember. I think it was using LEA to do something really fantastic. And he was just like, oh, yeah, that's a cheap way of doing this. And I'm like, I never would have figured that out. But
interesting. So I've heard Joel Spolsky say that the rule is you need to know one level below where you're working at. So if you're working in C#, you need to know IL.
Yeah.
But if you are working in IL, you need to know assembly.
Yes.
Is kind of the idea. And that seems like a pretty good rule. I wish I could stick to it. I just love knowing all the way down to the sand. Like, get that silicon on the chip, and like, how wide are those resistors, the width and the length? The computer engineers in the audience, two of them, will
by comparison, I work in the stratosphere. So,
right.
I mean, for me, PHP is the lower level that I work in, right?
Right, because you are mostly UI.
I work in JavaScript all day, and, you know. So
some people would say JavaScript is pretty low. people who are using CoffeeScript and
that's true. That's
things
true.
Of that nature would say JavaScript is the lower level there. What do you think of JavaScript? I've been for the last 6 months or so, JavaScript is kind of the language that I'm toying around with on the side. And
oh, really?
It's a fascinating language. I mean, one of the reasons is it was becoming very popular on Stack Overflow, and it's like, I need a new language to learn. Why don't I spend some time answering some, like, looking through the questions on Stack Overflow for JavaScript and then going out and kind of picking it up as a side language.
Yeah, so this gamification has really helped you personally. That's incredible. Sorry, go ahead, Ben.
No, I mean, JavaScript is a fascinating language, and I think almost everyone who's, you know, kind of delved deep in it has a love-hate relationship with JavaScript because you understand how – I don't want to say how poorly it was designed, but I mean, it was rushed out the door.
Well, it was designed in a week.
Yeah. And you know, it has glaring weaknesses, but at the same time, it's been built around, it's been built to serve the browser. And so it's kind of uniquely qualified to do things that just no other language.
How would you recommend people start learning JavaScript? So Jared says, go on Stack Overflow and take a look at the questions. But today we've got CoffeeScript, there's browser incompatibilities and stuff. There's just been a bunch of stuff built on top of it. How would you start?
Well, I came into JavaScript the absolute worst possible way. I came in, you know, backwards through like HTML and CSS because, as we've discussed earlier, I'm a graphic designer who became a front end developer. I would recommend starting with a book by Douglas Crockford called The Good Parts, which is
JavaScript The Good Parts.
Yeah,
okay. JavaScript. We'll put that in the show notes.
But I didn't read that until, you know, like a year ago, and.
But that's a hardcore languages book, which gets back to what we were talking about before, right? This talks about the syntax, and they've got not the abstract syntax tree, but they've got the grammar laid out on the Rails diagram. What do you know what that's called?
No.
No.
The railroad diagram.
Railroad diagram. Yeah, that actually might be it. That seems pretty intimidating, but it's pretty low level.
Yeah, I mean, it is a pretty low level language, and to some people, but yeah, it's a. I don't even know what to say about it aside from it's a huge pain in the ass most of the time, but you can also do some pretty incredibly weird things with it as well.
Yeah, the raising everything to global fucks me all the time.
Right, yeah. I mean, well, yeah, variables being stored as hashes, and so, you know, if you create a variable that, you know, doesn't exist, it'll just happily create it, and, you know, hash it up, and, you know, it'll go along its merry way, and you'll never know until later on that you didn't capitalize that variable name or, yeah.
But that's the problem with all dynamic languages. Would you rather code in dynamic or statically typed languages?
I don't know. At this point, I've kind of wrapped myself enough in JavaScript that I'm happy to work in a dynamic language. It's been a long time since I worked in a really, like, hardcore statically typed language as well. So,
Jared, what do you think about this? There's sort of a debate on the intertubes about dynamic languages versus static languages. Any thoughts?
I think they both kind of have their place. I mean, I have a huge static background. I mean, I program in F sharp all the time, which is, you know, about as static as you're going to get in terms of type safety and, you know, but one of the things, and I used to, if you'd ask me this question about a year ago, I would say, oh, static languages rule, JavaScript is, you know, the devil, and things of that nature. But as I've learned JavaScript and really kind of, I took a lot of time to kind of go through some of the Google intros on like how to code an HTML page properly, like go to CSS Zen Garden and look how nice or, you know, the clean separation of having an HTML file structure, have your CSS file and your JavaScript file using probably jQuery to hook everything up. And one thing that I've really kind of taken away from that when I started actually writing some UIs with JavaScript is I think I would really like – I really like coding GUIs in JavaScript. It is just so easy. It's so easy, and it's so nice.
Yeah,
and
that instant feedback you get when you just hit F5 after a change and boom.
And where I think I kind of ended up realizing is when I go back now and I do some like WPF coding, for example, they're all trying – if you do like model, view, model, and you go and do like proper JavaScript, it's the same basic concepts of you have a model, you have a view that's binding on top of that model, and you keep everything separate. And the only big difference is, one, if I do something wrong in JavaScript, like let's say I name the variable incorrectly or I type the wrong hashtag, the UI doesn't render correctly. If I get the bindings wrong in my WPF, what happens? The view just doesn't render correctly. Both have the exact same output, and the difference between JavaScript and WPF, for example, is that I end up coding a whole bunch more types. And it's still under the hood, the UI binding is dynamic. And so now I'm kind of the opinion of, in the UI, I like to just embrace the fact that it's dynamic. And I have now kind of, when I start coding even like C-sharp UIs, I just use dynamic because I just want to embrace the fact that even though I statically compiled everything, C-sharp told me I was great, the XAML didn't find any problems with my XAML, at runtime, it's still dynamically binding. It is not statically said my UI is awesome.
When you say dynamic, you mean the dynamic keyword.
Yes. When I say yes, so I mean both that the UI is dynamically using – by dynamic, I both mean the UI is kind of using reflection to go across the types to find the properties and hook everything up to the XAML, and that
the bindings,
like dynamic keyword.
What you're saying is – or what I think you're saying is that because it's so easy to tell when there's a problem on a UI, that it's fine to use dynamic typing for that because you can clearly see the problem. Other bugs in systems are subtle. They're like logic bugs.
Performance bugs.
They're incorrect, but they're not blatantly incorrect. Most people can't look at the output of a spreadsheet and know that there was a bug deep down generating those numbers. Whereas with a UI, you can tell something's off by 2 pixels or something's not getting populated.
That's absolutely true. I mean, it was a language made for visual people, and the tools built into the browsers like Firebug and Chrome's Element Inspector have risen up to kind of address the limitations of JavaScript in terms of, you know, finding bugs, locating, you know, breakpoints, have given you all the things that a regular compiler might provide you with.
When I was at Microsoft, one of the most interesting things about this topic that I heard was from a guy named Simeon Cran, who worked on the Oslo team. And he was very smart. And what he said was that computer languages are not for computers. They're for you and I. The computer doesn't understand, like, what it means to be a type, right? Everything in the computer is just ones and zeros and binary opcodes that go into this. And as such, we create these types for each other. When somebody else is reading the code, is the information beneficial for them? Now, this is Vance Morrison talking. He's like, is the information beneficial to the person reading it, the type?
Each language is a user interface in itself to the next level down.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. But I think computer programming languages are actually meant to be read, not to be written. And I think most computer programmers, they like dynamic typing because it's easier to write code. But it's so much harder to read. Well, if you have to modify dynamic code that you've never seen and they haven't done a good job of like naming their variables or whatever, you're like, what properties are available on this class? I mean, they're using classes. There is a type, but you just cannot figure it out. I mean, it takes you so much longer. Whereas in Visual Studio, because everything's statically typed in C# or in C++, you just hover over and you see the type, or you go to definition and it will put it all out. You've got IntelliSense. And so I'm much more in the static typing camp, even though it's a pain in the butt. It's for humans, not for computers.
Absolutely.
I mean, the other thing that gets me is just like, I mean, it's how much code can I keep in my head? Like, okay. A UI is generally pretty small. Like, the actual logic for UIs I've written is rarely more than 1,000 lines of code. And generally, I found that most developers can keep 1,000 lines of code in their head.
Right.
And if you can keep it all in your head and you know that, okay, well, I renamed this property, that property, or added this property, that means there's some invariant over here that I used to know about, that I know about, that I need to kind of deal with. But once I get into larger code bases, I'm my own worst enemy. And because human memory is terrible. And when you're asked to think of something more than this immediate vicinity, or like, oh God, like what was I thinking a year ago when I wrote that line of code in this, you know, because UIs are 1,000 lines of code. The code bases I deal with are hundreds of thousands of lines of code.
Yeah. Right. And all of Visual Studio, not just.
Yeah. Oh God, all of Visual Studio, millions. But even like in the subparts I work in, like I work a lot in the C# compiler these days, and it's, you know, it's a huge code base, and I'm my own worst enemy because, one, I think I'm remembering things correctly, and I'm not, because it's just so big. And if you ever look through my code, a lot of times when I'm coding, I'm defending not against some other programmer. I'm defending against the future version of me who's going to forget that I did this.
Which is another programmer in a way. Our future
it really
self.
Is. I wrote a whole blog post about this one time. It's like I am not the same person I was a year ago. I think about programming differently. Like now I think a lot like – it's like, oh, I've done JavaScript. So I think about dynamic properties. Or when I was getting F#, it's like, oh, I think a lot about lambdas. And you just don't approach problems the way you used to. But I always write code like I'm the past me approach the problems in the same way. And so if you look at my code, it is littered with asserts, long comments of this is why we did it this way. You know, if you think about changing this, you have to change these other things as well. And I'm always obsessing and trying to find new ways to statically prevent myself from making the mistakes I know I'm going to make at some point in the future. Like I look in API and it's like, okay, I know today that that has to be free before this function is called, but will I remember that a year from now? And okay, can I wrap that in a C++ type that just does it in the destructor so I don't have to remember this a year from now? And so I'm constantly trying to find new ways to basically save myself from me.
Yeah, I've definitely found that the longer I've coded, the more descriptive my comments become, because I found that, you know, when I come back to code, a short comment or, you know, a couple words might actually do more harm than good with the future me. We're onboarding new programmers at work right now, and I've found that I go in and I'll clean up code, you know, in anticipation of someone else having to look at it. I guess that's a little like, you know, cleaning your house before someone comes over. But
perfect.
But still, I mean, you have to walk in, you look at it with new eyes. You're like, how would I read this if I didn't know what it was doing?
I think it's important for comments to say why you're doing what you're doing, not
right.
What the thing is doing, because the what is in the language, in the programming language. But the why.
Right.
Like,
the comment is the why.
Why on earth would you do it this way? Oh, well, it turns out that there's some business requirement over here, or there's some other thing that we can't do it the obvious way. I found most code is not the obvious way.
Or apologizing for the hack you're writing as you're writing it.
I guess. Apologies.
Yeah, I've written a few of those.
What?
The way I look at code, because everyone's inherited someone else's code at some point. And yeah. Whenever you inherit someone else's code, you always find like Visual Studio is a huge code base. I've inherited tons of people's codes over the year. And, you know, if you get me in a corner, I'll tell you, it's like, oh my God, this code base did this. And it drove me absolutely crazy. I couldn't like, you know, why the hell did he ever think that this was a great idea? And the way I kind of approach code these days is when I think about who is the next guy who's going to pick up my code. The way I try to approach it is you might not agree with a single thing I did. You might hate every way I did things, but you're going to know why I did it that way.
Yeah. Right.
I want it to be very clear why I did it this way and what my constraints were at the time. And if you want to change it, that's great. I mean, I even checked in a comment a few days ago where I knew this one particular piece of code could be have a lot better perf. And I basically wrote down, it's like, if I know if we could reorder the tree in this way, this algorithm could be much faster. I tried these and ran into these. These are the problems we run into because you end up in another perf hole if you try this algorithm. But if you run into a perf hole, this is, you know, and you get to this function, you could make it faster by putting this tree in order. But here are the things I've tried and why they didn't work. You know, go from here. So far, it hasn't been a problem for us. But
yeah,
I've dealt with third-party APIs that have forced me to do things that I really didn't want to do. And so it's like, you know, dear future person, I hope they've fixed this, you know, in the next version. please forgive me. I wrote this against my will.
Those codes and comments are always fun. I think one of my favorites, and I believe this is public. I'll check. And if it's not, I'll remove this from the podcast, was like, here be dragons.
Here,
way down. That was in the Microsoft
code
base.
Here there be dragons.
Yes, that's fine. I once saw this whole comment section where it was very clear that it was a bunch of C programmers who were putting C++ templates in their code base for the first time. You've seen this comment, Jim.
ATL sign.
This one guy. No. The Neato. The Neato comment. This one dev had – he was clearly excited because he had found out this really great property of templates. They'd had an issue of like how do we delete things. And this code was written – I guess it had to be written in the mid-90s or something. So it was before there were a lot of places to really tell you how to write good templates.
I'd say 96. They were,
yeah, something like that. And they were trying to figure out how to call a destructor and this guy – or how to delete items in time. This one guy, like they done it and this guy's like – he's like, oh, this is the old way of doing it. It was bad. He's like, I found this really great way of doing it. Neato. And then there was a comment right below. It's like, no, it's not neato. And explained like, you know, when you have a pointer, it falls apart in this corner. And it was just this hilarious like half
page long
comment.
Back and forth through time.
Yes. It was really great. And there are some really great comments that I've come across where some people have been apologetic or like, well, I read this book and they said do it this way. And then I read this other book and they said do it another way and I think they're both wrong because of this, so I'm doing it my way.
And you're always like, speaking you're speaking forward in time as well. You're speaking to the next developer to read it. You're not actually replying to someone who's ever going to see it again potentially. You might be
yes.
talking to a person from many years ago and you're telling the next guy who's going to have to look at it.
You definitely explain to the next guy. My comments tend to come in kind of two tenses. There's one where I'm explaining to someone reading the code, like, this is why I did something. But I also, when I design objects, mm-hmm. a lot of my comments are written in the first person from the perspective of the object. It's like, I'll write, like, my job is to make sure that, you know, I want to make sure that you don't screw me over here. Or, like, my job is to make sure that this collection is always in this particular state. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of bothered people a few times when they've read my comments. But
We were talking a little earlier about the future us and comments, but I was wondering if you think that code reuse has been a success or failure in computer software.
Kind of mixed. Like when I see my first like real experience with coding is like I did a whole lot of like C++ code, and I generally find that code is reused really successfully in C++ because people just copy and paste it into their directories. Like there's okay. like I know for a fact, like there's parts of codes I've worked on before where it's like it was just giant and copy and paste from other people's ideas. And I've actually solved problems that way before where we had a real issue with memory management. And I went and talked to another team who had solved the exact same problem before. And I took their code, just put it into our directory, and it worked like a champ and solved
what the allocator and VB.
Yeah, the allocator and VB. We had a real problem with it. I went and talked to the C# team and said, you know, what do you guys do? And they had actually had the same problem and talked to the C++ team years ago. And so
Oh, that part of the story I didn't know.
Yeah, because I went and sat down, I talked with Ed, and Ed told me, he's like, oh yeah, we had that same problem and we did this. And so I was like, oh, well, I'll take your solution and move it over and see how it works in our world. And it wasn't 100% perfect fit, but it was – we ended up spending I think probably a grand total of a week and a half working on that code, and the estimate to write it ourselves from scratch was like 2 months. But so in that respect, it was successful. But when code – people talk about code sharing, I think they usually mean like DLLs and like having one copy of the code.
Right.
And it seems like that's a lot more successful in C# and .NET than C++. And I would say the only reason why is just because it's so much easier. Like creating
Linking a library.
Yeah, and just like I, for instance, at one point in time, did a whole lot of work on changing how like our fundamental libs worked because when I first started on the team, we were not using STL. We were not using we had a really interesting way of doing global heaps, and I changed it to be much more in line so that we could start using STL and start having what a normal C++ developer would recognize as kind of C++ way of doing things. Mm-hmm. And just even with all the time I spent like researching how our code worked and everything, I would still like I'd check it in. It would blow up in the lab like a week later because I didn't realize our lib had been linked somewhere else and that that meant that they had control of the allocator and we didn't anymore. And it's just it was so hard to have enough control of your environment in C++ that it made code sharing really, really difficult for me. But in C#, you have less control, and it's just easier to create libraries. And so I see reuse all the time there.
Do you think object-oriented programming has lived up to its code reuse hype?
In some ways, yeah. I mean, it definitely in what way? Let's be clear.
Well, there's this idea, do not repeat yourself.
Yeah.
And a lot of patterns and things like that, I think, come from the do not repeat yourself. Like, oh, I had to copy and paste. The first form of code reuse is copy paste, which is what you were talking about before. And it's like, right. Oh, I have to do something over here. I have to do the exact same thing, or worse, something very similar but slightly different over there.
Yeah.
And so I will copy that code, paste it, and I'll make the modification that I need to do. And I actually think that version form of code reuse is very successful. I think that happens all the time. But,
right. I come from the world of copy and paste, where everything's a plugin or an extension. Yeah, in JavaScript and jQuery.
Right. And the downfall to that is that you don't get bug fixes. Right. When somebody finds a problem with a compression algorithm that you've copied and pasted, and they're like, oh, in this edge case, it doesn't work correctly. Let me update the code. You don't get that update. Whereas if you were linking to a library, you would. Or even if it was in an encapsulated class that somebody else wrote and you were just instantiating that class, you would get that bug fix in whatever the function is
Fix might break you.
And that bug fix will probably break you, which is why I don't know if encapsulation, like in the object-oriented thing, the whole idea is code reuse, right? Well, we're going to encapsulate, we're going to put the data and the functions that work on the data together, and then you'll just be able to use that piece over and over again. And I actually think that that's failed. I don't know anybody who's using object-oriented programming the way that it should be without jumping through massive hoops, coming up with design patterns and things like that, and then just using them to death in order to get code reuse out when it would have been faster to copy and paste.
For me, I just kind of go day to day what works. I mean, I've wasted a lot of time trying to have that don't repeat yourself mentality and just saying that, oh, these are so close together, they really should just be one little, like, you know, there should be one function with maybe a lambda to tweak it here or a lambda to tweak it there. And like one that's bit me a tons of times is how to like write Vim motions. Like there's this whole class of motions in Vim called text objects. And so it's like inner word, all word. And if you read the Vim documentation, which is prolific, and by that I mean there's one paragraph on how this should work, it's like, oh, all motions work by including the white space when it's this way and not including the white space when it's that way. And then you go and try to encode it. You're like, oh, there should just be one. I should just be able to identify the objects and then just apply this count algorithm to it. And then you like make it work for word, and then you go and look for sentences, and you find out, oh, well, sentences, yeah, that new line kind of looks differently if you start on it or if you end on it. And then I spent like literally like 3 days like trying to write this perfect like count algorithm. And then one day I stepped back and said, you know what? I've got three lambdas coming into this. you know, I'm just going to copy paste and I'm just going to make it work that way. And I spent 3 days trying to make it work this beautiful don't repeat yourself thing, and then I copy and paste and I was done in 2 hours.
That's all I have to talk about.
Cool.
Do you want to do the pro tips thing? Do you have a tip, Jared?
Oh, yes. Yeah, all tip right. of the week. If you're a Git user, so my background is I spent a whole lot of time, like most people, like I actually, my first version control system ever was RCS, which probably no one ever remembers. RCS is CVS was actually a bunch of scripts on top of RCS, and RCS was, if I remember correctly, it was basically a way of doing like file by file version control, like on Unix, like way, way, way back in the day. And I graduated from RCS to CVS to SVN, and now I've used like Perforce, TFS, and a bunch of other, and I've kind of transitioned into Git. And one of the things is I started out by approaching Git like I would approach SVN or something else, like pull, commit, pull, add, commit, push, and didn't ever really think about it. But I've lately been spending a lot of time after listening to like the most recent Herding Code podcast, where they talked a lot with like Paul Betts on how like advanced Git stuff. Mm-hmm. But my tip of the day is Git stash. If you're coming more from like a TFS or a Subversion background where you've never really had the power of Git, one thing that'll kind of start cluing you in is stash. And stash is the classic, I'm halfway through a bug fix and I'm like, okay, oh, I need to fix this API over here. And then you look at it and you're like, that's actually its own bug. And then you're kind of in Subversion world, I'd be faced with the choice of, what do I do? Like, I have a whole bunch of changes and I just found another bug and I can't really fix the first thing I'm working on until I fix this thing over here. And so do I lump it all into one set, or do I check out another copy of my repo and I fix it over there, then push, and then I sync and merge? And it's just come to – and git stash is the answer. I get halfway through a bug fix now and you just say git stash. Takes everything in your workspace, stashes it into the Git repository, puts you back to reset your branch to head.
Before
you make the bug fix. Yeah, it makes it – it resets basically like I haven't done anything. You haven't lost any work. It basically just takes your changes and puts them aside. You go, you fix the bug, you check in, you say git stash pop, and bam, it'll take all that work you just had, it'll merge it back into your tree, and you're ready to go again on top of the new bug fix. And it's taken me for a place, because I'm a constant refactorer, and I'll get halfway through a bug fix and I'm like, I just hate the way that API looks. And I obsessively have to go and change it and make it look the way I know it needs to look at that point in time. And I used to have these giant check-ins where I get – it was really a simple bug fix that ended up like touching half my code base because I realized I wanted to rename an API. And now with Git Stash, it's like, oh, they're separate check-ins. I'm like, oh, that API needs to be renamed, and then I'll do a bug fix on top of it. But it's like now that I found Git Stash, I use it all the time.
Nice. So my pro tip for the week is actually related to Visual Studio 2010. It's the new multi-targeting features that are there. I worked on these features a little bit when I was at Microsoft. I worked on them for Visual Basic, and at the time I didn't understand why we were doing them. But now that I'm out in the real world, I use this all the time. So it turns out that there's lots and lots of legacy systems and legacy code out there. The most common example of which is you have a library from, say, like 2000 that you're using for low-level C++ sockets, like something like Smart Sockets from TIBCO. You cannot recompile that in the latest Visual Studio. And so you need to be able to link to it with an older version of the compiler, which usually in the past meant that you had to install VC6 or VS 2005 or 2008, and you could no longer use the best tools for the job. But now in Visual Studio 2010, you can down-target from – you can use Visual Studio 2010 to write all your codes, but then use the older version of the compiler to generate your output for C and C++. And now in managed code, this is even more neat, because if you are targeting .NET 4.0, or .NET 3.5, but your output needs to be 2.0 because you're linking to a library that's only 2.0, or you're deploying to a server that you don't have access to that only runs on 2.0, it will take the advanced features from 3.5 and 4.0, like multi-line statement lambdas and implicit line continuation from Visual Basic, and it will rewrite them in 2.0 compliant IL. So you can use the advanced features and target 2.0. It's actually really cool for both C# and Visual Basic. And so I think this is a feature that people don't know exists or forgot that exists from launch day, but you can use Visual Studio 2010 to maintain your old legacy systems and use the best tools while still being compliant backwards.
Yeah, and people definitely don't realize that. I spend a lot of time on Stack Overflow correcting people because they're like, oh, you need CLR 4.0 or CLR 3.5 to do lambdas. And it's like, no, actually, you can do it on 2.0. You just need the 4.0 C# compiler to do it. And people have this disconnect where they believe that it's C# 4 only works with, 4.0 framework or whatnot. And I spend a lot of time educating people. It's like, yeah, no, you can do really cool. You can do most of these features, pretty much everything but expression trees, back to 2.0. But yeah, once people like clue into it though, it's really awesome.
Yeah. Ben, you have a tip?
So there's a little program I've started to use on all my laptops and on my workstation at work. It's called Flux. It's actually spelled f.lux. It changes the color temperature of your monitor in accordance with the time of day. And so if you work in if you work in an office that has an outside window, you might notice that toward the end of the day your monitor starts looking really blue to you because the light coming into your office has changed so much. And it'll actually adjust for that during you know, according to the time of day, and actually make your monitor more warm and match the indoor light during the evening, and then it'll make it cooler, more blue during the day. So
it's supposed to not mess with your sleep.
I was gonna say, is it like location specific? In Seattle, yes. Is it just a solid gray background?
Yeah, it'll take your. But yeah, it'll take your zip code. You know,
it'll make your monitor look wet.
Nice,
but just slightly.
I actually do use a little white noise generating site called rainymood.com. That's one of my favorites. If I don't feel like listening to music and I just want, you know, white noise in the background, it's just the sound of rain all day. It's nice. It's like a 2-hour thunderstorm someone recorded over and over again.
I do like that. I like thunderstorms. Do you miss thunderstorms, Jared?
God, I miss them so much. I get them about because I spend a week every year at the beach with my mom's side of the family, and usually in North Carolina, South Carolina, and we usually get one good thunderstorm while I'm down there. But it's just always there in the South. But here we get like one thunderstorm every 2 years, and I miss it a lot.
I miss mountains from Seattle. I'm not going to lie. That was always fun. All right, that's all I've got, dude.
No, I'm
Jared, good. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yes, this has been awesome.
Really awesome.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's been great.